What's up, UXers? Before we dive into this episode of the UX Hustle with Angel Banks, I've got a few updates and an opportunity to let you know about. So first, I want to invite you to OOUX Summer School. This is a weekend boot camp on object-oriented UX, of course. It's happening August 22nd and 23rd. So this is 10 hours of live training split between 2 days. It is about as hands-on as it can get in a virtual setting. So it's $497, but please let us know if you need a break on that price. I want as many people to be there as possible, and I want this to be as accessible as possible. So if you are experiencing unemployment or underemployment due to COVID or really any other reason, if your career has been thwarted by systemic racism, if the value of your currency in whatever country you're in makes this price tag astronomically high, or really any other reason that this price is just inaccessible to you, please just send us a quick note. You can send that to hello@rewiredux.com and we will email you a discount code for 95% off. That's 95% off. So it makes it about $25 for a full weekend of training. No questions asked, just email us and we will get that discount code to you. So if you or hopefully your employer can make that price work, I promise the weekend will give you 100 times, maybe even 1,000 times a return on your investment. You're basically going to be able to more gracefully and more collaboratively solve complex UX problems. And over the years of your career, that is going to be priceless, I promise. Also, if you decide to fully join the OOUX tribe by signing up for cohort 3 of the OOUX Strategist Certification course that starts on September 30th, you'll be able to apply that $497 to the cost of the certification. Finally, to make sure that you are feeling absolutely no risk, I'm going to give you a money back promise. So if after you do the boot camp, fully participate in the boot camp, if you don't think you're going to use anything that you learned, if you don't feel like it was valuable and time and money well spent, I'm going to issue a refund, no questions asked. If you can afford that price tag, please go for it. It helps support me. It helps support the work that we're doing over here at Rewired to continue to bring object-oriented UX to our community, help us do information architecture in a really methodical way. Please check it out. You can go to ouxsummerschool.eventbrite.com. The link is going to be in the show notes at the very bottom, so just scroll all the way to the bottom, and then you can pop over there, get the full agenda, the full details of the weekend, and hopefully you decide that it's going to be right for you and you decide to make that investment. Okay, so in other news, I have a big announcement about the future of the UX Hustle podcast. So in the next few weeks, I'm going to be winding down I'm going to be winding down the UX Hustle podcast, perhaps I might be handing it off to another host. Still working out some details there, but I'm going to be spinning up a brand new podcast. And this new podcast is going to be doubling down on object-oriented UX and information architecture and content strategy and all that geeky in the weed stuff that I love. I'm really going to be trying to focus in on that. So I'm still going to dabble in career development and productivity stuff because I can't not do that. It's another passion of mine. But really the lion's share of the content is going to be interviews with OUXers and people that OUXers can learn from to just continue to refine our process. I'm still brainstorming names for the new podcast. I got a short list going, and I'm going to be asking my newsletter to vote on a new name on Monday. So if you're not on the newsletter, please trust me with your very precious email address. No spam, I promise, only good stuff. Go to rewiredux.com/newsletter. That link is also going to be in the very bottom of the show notes, and you can sign up for the newsletter and vote on Monday for the new name of the new podcast, or the name of the new podcast. Okay, guys, let's get to the episode. I really hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed recording it. I've tangentially known Angel Banks for years now. We're both design community organizers here in Atlanta, and we've been supporting and even speaking at each other's events. And we cross paths regularly. But in this conversation, we actually get to know each other. It's an absolute honor to be able to help you get to know Angel Banks as well. She is a UX designer. She's a UX event designer and organizer. She's a technologist. She has background in development, and she's even a brand design artist. Enjoy the episode. On with the show.
What's up, UX designers? Welcome to the UX Hustle Podcast. This is a show about having fun designing intuitive and valuable experiences and crafting a fulfilling career within UX design. Now here's your host, Sophia Wojciechowski-Prater.
Okay, so Angel, all right, you are a powerhouse. You're a powerhouse of community organizing. You're also a UX designer. You've been a product manager, also a developer. And then you do visual design and branding too. You kind of dabble in that a little bit as well. So yeah, I'm going to use the terrible term unicorn. I think that like if I'm going to call anybody a unicorn, it's probably going to be you. So I have a whole lot of questions about that, about digging into all the things you do. But backing up, we need to back way up because I want to ask you about your journey into UX, but I think we actually need to start with your mom's journey into UX.
Yeah. My mom, so I didn't even really know, like most people, I didn't even know what UX was, and I didn't know that's what she did. she also, and I only found this out recently, started out as a developer. At like Pacific Bell, which was a phone company for the people who aren't, who are a little younger.
Wow.
Used to be a phone company. So she was a developer. And then I don't even know if I 100% understand her transition into UX, but you know, she had a journalism degree from Stanford. So she was a writer. So I think her path was kind of in content. And I remember editing for her, she was doing technical manuals. So she was writing manuals for software and I would help edit. So I think that's where her journey started into UX because she started doing the content. And then, she's always been doing it. And I can't even tell you when it started, but she's been in at least for, I don't know, 20 years. Is that true? Is that possible?
So this is like, I mean, early 2000s, late 90s, yeah. She was doing UX design before we were even calling it UX design, I guess she was doing it. So she was super early into this. And I think it's funny to know that she started in development and then started recommending UX to you. And you ended up having a convoluted journey as well. Like when she was recommending it, like what was your, first of all, what do you think she saw in you that she was like, Angel's going to make a good UX designer?
I think a couple things, as I mentioned, I did edit for her. So I just kind of started, she was a consultant for many years and I would help her in various ways. But I think even before I got into tech, I was kind of like a problem solver. So whatever job I was working, I was usually at a startup where you wear many hats and there's no process to anything. There's no strategy to anything. And I would just kind of take on that role at whatever job I was at. And I think that's what she saw in me, but I still never got it. I was like, I thought it was like, you know, making websites pretty. So I just didn't understand why I would necessarily be good at that. Not a particularly good artist or anything. So just not my, I just think not understanding what design really was or what UX really was made it hard for me to grasp what I would be good at.
Wow. Okay. So when you actually first started in UX, so you transitioned from development, you said, okay, I'm going to go with development. And was your mom like, oh, Angel, no, you're going to end up in UX design? Or was she encouraging of you getting into starting that development bootcamp?
So actually I worked for her for a year before I got into web development as a designer.
Oh, wow.
So what happened is I actually made that transition from running a law firm into UX. I just kind of knew it was time for me to move on from that. I enjoyed many aspects of my job, my previous jobs, but I always had the most boring job at a really cool company. So I think I was just kind of tired of being the one who had to do all the boring stuff. And I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I just knew I needed to like push myself to move. So I started working for her. I worked about a year, and she kept telling me, well, maybe you should look into going to a web development boot camp. You might like it, pays really well. And I finally, she told me that for about a year, and I finally decided to do it. And on a whim, I was applying to all these boot camps in the Bay Area in California. And I heard General Assembly was opening one in Atlanta. And I just decided to apply to the Atlanta General Assembly. And if I got into that, I was going to move to Atlanta. And if I didn't, I was going to stay in the Bay Area. And it was the first interview, and I got in. So I moved to Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
To be a developer.
I did not know that was the reason that you moved, that it was General Assembly opening up here. So thank you, General Assembly, for bringing Angel to Atlanta. You've been great for Atlanta.
Yeah, I moved to Atlanta without knowing anyone, but my mom had just recently, on a whim, also bought like a retirement home in Georgia. So it was kind of in my mind, but she hadn't moved. She was still working in the Bay Area. And so I moved to a really small town outside of Atlanta for a while I was going to General Assembly. And yeah, it was just kind of like, what am I doing? I'm living in the state. I don't know anyone. And I'm trying to pursue this career that I only been made aware of like 2 minutes ago.
So as you were going through that and you were realizing like, what am I doing here? I've changed everything about my life. Like, what kept you going forward?
I think the danger of a boot camp doesn't give you really a lot of time to think, honestly, about what you're doing or where you're going. It's like, it's 3 months, it's 9 to 5, and then you're doing homework. My life kind of became the boot camp and the people at the boot camp for several months, because it's just really short time frame and that's all you have. So I don't think I really had time to think, what am I doing? How's it going to work? So like, I just have to get to the end and then see what happens, because what else am I going to do? I packed up everything. I don't have an apartment in the Bay Area. I've shipped my car to Atlanta. Like, this is it. Whatever we're doing next, it's going to be here, because
yeah.
It's not cheap to move across country. And
well, it sounds like you fully committed to it. I mean, you committed to it by moving, and a boot camp is just, it is such a commitment that there was like, all right, we're going to run this program.
No idea. I think also in addition, even though I didn't stay in web development, the connections I made through boot camp, the people I met, I mean, if I hadn't had such a great cohort, I don't know if I would have stayed in Atlanta. It was my community for quite a while as I kind of tried to figure out what was next. Beth Ling, she's one of my co-directors at WomenCo. We actually met there. Mm-hmm. So she was also going to the boot camp, and she's my best friend now. So I don't, even though I didn't stay in web development, without that, I don't know where I'd be living, where it would be, what I would be doing.
So not just the connections that you met, but I'm sure also the skills that you learned as a developer do serve you in UX design. How important do you think it is? This is the billion-dollar question. How important do you think it is for UX designers to know how to code or to understand the underlying technologies?
So I wouldn't say that you'd have to learn code or even like it. I think understanding the technology, especially the ones that your engineering team is using, and of course it changes sometimes and you can't keep up with everything, it really is more helpful in conversations. I think collaboration with engineering is very important, especially at some companies where engineering kind of has more say in the final product. I think being able to communicate with engineers is crucial. And if you come from a place of kind of understanding what language they're using, actually didn't mean it like that, but both the language they're using and also how they speak, I think it helps with that communication. I always think the best way to talk to engineers is just kind of explaining to them why you did something. I think that there's sometimes, I'm not to generalize too much, but I think there's an idea that maybe designers just do things to make it look good, and that there was no reasoning or background to why you made those decisions. And I find talking to engineers about why you made a decision helps find like a happy medium between what you designed and then what might be the final product.
And that, I mean, that kills two birds with one stone, because it can help when you communicate to developers to make sure that they understand that your decisions are not completely arbitrary, but also from a business perspective too, so that they understand. So it really comes down to, what I'm hearing is like, being able to defend your design decisions And mm-hmm. I mean, even to explain to yourself, I mean, I know that a lot of times UX designers do make arbitrary decisions. And just to realize like, oh, I'm making an arbitrary decision. Maybe I should look at best practices. Maybe I should do some research on this because I've just pulled something out of a hat and put it on a screen. So you got into community organizing here in Atlanta relatively early in your career, mm-hmm. right? And your, I mean, it was like right after General Assembly.
Yeah.
What was the first group that you started?
This is so funny, but so three of the people I went to General Assembly with had a conversation. I don't know where I was at the time, but they decided to create like an Angular meetup group. So it was around that framework because we had learned it in boot camp. And we thought it was like a good thing to put on your resume. Everyone's worried about getting a job. So they started a meetup group. I joined like a month later. I was helping them and then officially joined as an organizer about a month later. So that was my first, the first group I start that I was involved with. And it was really right after boot camp because I didn't know what I was doing. I needed something to do. And of course, I think definitely thinking that it would look good on the resume to have some kind of technical community thing going on. I didn't know what it would grow into or what I would enjoy it so much. I didn't have a plan. I didn't know how long I'd do it. I just thought, let's throw it on the resume. Let's get this going.
Wow. So, I mean, and now it's gone so far. I mean, you are, I'm going to try to read them all out. It's going to take a minute. So co-director of Women Who Code, you are, you're leading Women Tech Makers Atlanta. You're co-organizer of a Google development group. You're doing some instruction still here and there at General Assembly?
Not so much. I now do more, I'm involved with Thinkful, but yeah, I did that for a while.
Also co-organizer at Refactor Tech, DevFest, also We Rise in the past. So not only mm-hmm. meetups you've organized, but conferences. And I know from personal mm-hmm. experience that is a whole different ball game. I went from organizing meetups and being like, why not just do a conference? And then realizing like, it is so much more difficult. So many more moving pieces as far as organizing. So all these groups and all these events that you have, even some one-off events here and there, what do you think they all have in common? Like, what are you really trying to accomplish mm-hmm. in Atlanta or in your career or for people that come to your events?
Yeah, I think, so it started with the Angular meetup group here in Atlanta. I went from it being kind of a selfish thing. Then I wanted to have something on my resume, but then I realized it is terrifying when you're starting a new job to not have people who understand what you're going through. If I didn't have the cohort at General Assembly, I don't know what I would have done. And so I found that people were using these meetups as kind of a place to find like people, to find people to connect with, to find people to network with, just to better understand the technology. And I realized that there's so much more you could do as a meetup organizer to make sure people aren't feeling lost. I mean, every developer especially, but designers too have the imposter syndrome. So these were kind of places and opportunities to help people understand that you're not alone. Everyone feels this way, no matter how long they've been doing it. And so after that, after I realized like this is an opportunity to really help people, we started doing more as a meetup group. We did a full day workshop on Angular. We started trying to figure out new ways to make sure we're actually getting the community involved and doing what they want, what the information they want, the content they want, to make sure we're serving them. And so everything I've done since then, every meetup group, every conference, every event, is to serve the community, to give them a place to be safe, to feel secure, to feel heard, and to grow. And so that's what keeps me going, no matter how many meetups I do. And it gets hard. It's just like making sure that we find, you know, there's some gaps. There's some people in tech who aren't, people don't focus on, groups that don't mm-hmm. people don't focus on, and finding those gaps and creating an opportunity for them to feel like tech is for them as well.
Right. And I want to ask you more about that and kind of dig into that. So what kind of progress or not progress have you seen in Atlanta in the past few years from being a community organizer, also being in the community, on creating, I'm actually going to quote you, creating a safe and inclusive community for the marginalized and underrepresented in tech. Like, what progress have we made, and where does our, specifically Atlanta or the tech community at large, where do we have more work to do?
Oh, that's a great question. So when I joined Women Who Code Atlanta, so Beth and I, as I mentioned, we went to Jonestown together. We both are directors at Women Who Code Atlanta, and it was clear that, like, at least at that time, the focus was getting more women in tech, helping them stay. A lot of women leave tech after a few years, and trying to fix that, you know, solve that problem. How do we get women to stay in tech? How do we create a community to make them feel comfortable? And that's when we did We Rise, which was a conference out of Women Who Code that focused on women in tech. And it was very successful. We had a lot of, you know, corporate sponsors, and it was well attended, about 500 people. The majority of the attendees were women. And it was a comp that accomplished our goal to get more women in tech and to make them feel like it's a safe place to stay. However, after that, we realized that these companies, these organizations who partnered with us were helping women in tech, but the benefit was a net benefit more for white women. Mm-hmm. And there were all these other groups who were left out. And that's actually how Refactor.tech was born. We realized if we focus on women in tech, then white women in tech will have a better place, and that's great. But then what happens to everyone else? Mm-hmm. And so Refactor.tech is a conference for all of the underserved populations in tech, all of the underrepresented marginalized groups. You know, we try to make sure we have LGBTQ, you know, Black, Latinx, everyone non-binary should feel like this is a place for me as an attendee and for me as a speaker. So I feel like that's still where tech has a lot to go. I mean, if you look at the world around what's happening right now, there's so many, you know, there's maybe an awakening happening right now, which is great, but these are conversations that we've been trying to have for a very long time. And so I think tech especially still has a very long way to go. But hopefully there's a shift now, and events like Refactor and Render ATL will maybe move the ahead a little faster, I hope.
Right. I mean, I would definitely reinforce that. I feel like there's an awakening. There's been an awakening for me personally. There's been an awakening for people around me, and it's, you know, it sucks that it took so long, but it is definitely happening. So can I ask you, I have actually a question, like a phone in question from a girlfriend of mine. So knowing that you do a lot of coaching as well, you have your own coaching business, and you're coaching mainly women, right? And women from these marginalized communities. So I have a very dear girlfriend. She is, she's a brown woman, and she's a UX designer and getting very disillusioned with our world, with the technology world. So she's been in UX for quite a few years now and has been kind of gone through quite a few jobs. In general, it's a revolving door. It was a revolving door for me as well. But for her especially, it did feel like a revolving door. And she has noticed this pattern of she gets kind of worked to the bone. People sort of expect her to work longer hours, to produce more, that she will be available after hours. So it's a combination of feeling like she's being taken advantage of, and also that she's not being heard when she comes with her more strategic advice or more strategic recommendations. She's not getting heard. So as a coach, and as she's really feeling disillusioned and really feeling like she needs to change careers, but I'm thinking like, we need her. She's so smart. Like, please stay in this business. Mm-hmm. Like, what would you say to her?
Wow. That is such a, so I went through this a lot, especially when I was younger. And even before I moved, I was working at tech companies, but I wasn't in tech at the time. So I was a compliance manager at a tech company and doing like taxes and stuff like that. And I had that same feeling because I remember my boss's boss was like this guy from Coca-Cola. He's been a CFO for years and just very old school. And I knew that I was going to have to work really long hours and make sure that, I remember he'd always be the first one in and the last one out. So I had to stay, come in earlier than him and leave after him. And some days he would work till 8:30 at night. And I would work, you know, 12-hour days because I knew that if I wanted to get a promotion or a raise, he was the decision maker and he had to physically see me to know what I was doing. And I did that for a year and a half, I think. And I just realized this isn't healthy. This isn't a great situation to be in. And I shouldn't have to work longer than everyone and harder than everyone to get recognized by people who were leaving the office at 5 o'clock. It was just, you know, I know as a person of color, that's, we've been told that we have to do that. And that's the expectation, is that we're going to have to work harder and longer than everyone else. And I wish there was a solution. I can't say, well, take care of yourself, don't do it. I mean, that's a great answer, and you should, but just understand you have no idea what the consequences of that is going to be. If you're comfortable, you know, taking care of yourself and doing what's right for yourself and your family, and working what's a normal day for everyone else, I mean, if you're in a position to do it, I would do it. But if I don't have an answer to how other people perceive your effort, and that's the problem with tech. You know, there's no solution that we can, as people of color, change the perception and attitudes of the people who are managing us. And I, you know, I made the decision for myself that I would never do that for a company again. I work what everyone else does, and I work, I don't do that anymore. And that's a decision I made personally, that I just wouldn't do that, to continue to feel undervalued and to feel, you know, that I was being taken advantage of, frankly. But I can't say that there aren't consequences to that either.
Right.
And I just don't have a solution, except that you should do what's right for you and know that it's okay, that you shouldn't have to work more and you shouldn't have to work longer. But I don't have an answer to that, because it's just kind of the way things have been and continue to be.
And you don't necessarily want to have to be the one to like start breaking the cycle and be and right. feel that backlash.
Yeah, of course. And you don't know how to, you can't say it, because then people think you're playing a victim. I mean, there's so many consequences to pointing out what's wrong. And when you're, especially when you're, you know, one or the, you know, only one of a couple people of color working at that company, and, you know, do you really have the power to stand up and say that without there being consequences? You know, it's not really on us to figure out the problems and how to solve them of the group that is in control. So I wish I had a better answer that, but, you know, I just can't, you know, I don't like to give answers that feel good, but aren't really based in reality.
And that's totally fair. And I mean, just, it's something like the advice that I would have given even a few months ago, before really understanding the place of privilege that I'm coming from, it would be, oh, you need to set boundaries. Like, set boundaries early, because if you start working late, then it's going to be a slippery slope. Oh, you stay till six, and then somebody's going to think it's okay. They need you to stay till seven. And that advice might not apply to everybody, which...
Right. And yeah. And at that job, when I continued to work that, I finally did get promoted. And then I made less money as a manager, because I was working so much overtime before. And as a manager, you don't get overtime. So that's what I was probably like, okay, this system is not going to work for me anymore, and I need to do what's right for me personally and just never feel that way again.
So to be proactive, like, what are some, if my friend does move on from this role where she is being undervalued, and not only her time but also her mental genius is also being undervalued, and she starts moving on to the next thing, what are some ways, like, what are some during the interview, what are some ways to feel out the company as you are interviewing them that maybe on the surface might seem equitable and inclusive and enlightened, but how can you tell? Sometimes it's months, I guess, before you actually start seeing those things.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can do preemptively to understand what type of organization you might be getting involved with?
Yeah, it is hard, because people tell you in interviews the things that they're supposed to say as a company, and you don't really know if it's true. And you also don't know this person's bias and their perception of things that are maybe truthful. So I definitely, when I have especially when I have a screen call, the first interview in the process, I like to ask questions. I actually sometimes ask the same questions to each person I interview with, and they're general questions. How would you describe the culture? And I try not to lead them. Like, would you say it's a good culture? Like, I just ask them to describe the culture. I look up the company, try to see how, you know, usually if you look at the company in LinkedIn, it'll have the employees that are on LinkedIn anyway. It'll have them there, and you can kind of see the diversity of the company, see who's left. So when you search the company, it'll show former employees. So you start to see like a lot of women or people of color who were former employees. That might tell you a little something. Some companies have their team on the website, so that's another place you can go. I also search on Twitter, because sometimes people put the companies they work for on there, and you can kind of see what they're talking about on Twitter. Are they topics, are they issues that are important to you? Do they have opinions that may concern you? Because that's the culture. I mean, everyone is entitled to their opinion, but that is the culture. So if you can find them on Twitter, that's a good place to kind of get an idea of the people who are working there. I also like to remind myself that when you're interviewing, even if you don't have a job, even if you're like desperate, you're still interviewing the company as well. And so you should have questions, and you should ask them and feel comfortable asking them. You should, whatever's important to you, you should ask them straight up. And it might not be a fit, and you have to be okay with that. That, you know, this might not work for me. This is not the kind of culture I want to be in. So definitely I always have like a set of questions I ask consistently, but, you know, create your own questions that you always ask at the end or throughout the interview. And ask them of everyone in the process. The recruiter might have a perspective that's different than an engineering manager, that's different than a designer. And don't be afraid to interview them. Like, you just ask if you really, culture is very important to me. So I've been asking a lot of culture questions, because I'm actually looking myself. And I'm getting more comfortable with asking them very specific questions about the culture. Like, what's the work-life balance? What do you like about working there? What do you think you need work on, you know, as a culture or whatever? So. Mm-hmm. You know, these are kind of questions, even if they give you answers that are kind of stock or what the company would say, sometimes you can get little clues in how they respond, the facial expression they give when you ask the question. Those are kind of things you need to start picking up on.
Or even like, and that's all amazing advice. I mean, you could even dig further if you get a stock answer of like asking for some storytelling, like give me some examples of when you felt like the culture was really shining, or give me an example of when the culture, you feel like the culture wasn't was not at its best. That could be interesting too. That's all really great advice. And I mean, do you think that it's, is there any like ethical considerations with actually following up with past employees and asking them about why they left?
You know, I've never thought of that. I mean, I don't know.
I think it would be fine.
I mean, what are they going to do, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, that's doing your due diligence, right? Like, why did you leave? So if you see a lot of women leaving, a lot of people of color leaving, like, reach out to them and ask them what happened.
And if you're comfortable on Twitter, I have not done this, but something you can do is, you know, just put a tweet out there. Hey, I'm looking at this company. If anyone has any stories or feedback or whatever, you know, my DMs are open. Mm-hmm. Maybe people are more comfortable reaching out to you and kind of having a private conversation. So social media is your friend. It doesn't have to all be dark and depressing. I try to leverage the good parts of social media when possible.
Yeah. And that was another one of my questions, because I have heard you say that before, that it's that social media is can be leveraged in a way that is very productive and healthy. What are some like rules of thumb on leveraging social media without like going insane?
Yeah, I think my answer has changed on this sometimes, because I also didn't realize, I have not had terribly negative experiences on Twitter, but some people have. And so I say this to say, if you're comfortable, do not force yourself. If it does not make you feel good to engage on Twitter or Facebook or social media, then you shouldn't do it. It's not for everyone. And there is a lot of stuff out there that can just hurt your soul to see consistently on social media. And sometimes you have to just take a break or delete your account, or, you know, do what works for you. I like to use it. Like I said, I haven't had terribly negative experiences, so it's worked for me. And, you know, something to consider is if you are interested in a company, specific company, maybe following some of the people who work there. If you're interested in designer and you see a designer at the company that you want to work for, maybe follow them, see what they're talking about. You never know when they're going to tweet that they're hiring. I actually am going through an interview process right now for a job I saw on Twitter. Someone I don't know, but we follow each other. She just happened to be the hiring manager at the role for the role. And I would not have seen this job if it had not been for Twitter.
I mean, I've met so many and like started so many relationships through Twitter that like once you finally meet in person at a conference or something, you're like, go up and hug them.
Yeah, and that's happened to me a lot. I like to attend conferences. I speak at them. And one of the things I did when I was just trying to figure out this tech thing was engaging with people on Twitter, you know, comment on things that they're talking about, share things with them. And then when you're at a conference together, you actually have like a friend. You're like, oh, we've never met in person, but I feel like I know you. And now we can have a conversation and I don't feel so alone. So they're definitely great ways to start relationships on social media that you can actually carry into physical events if we ever have those again. And I've done that so many times. I mean, there are people I think I know and then realize I have not met this person in person at all. And it's helped a lot, especially as a conference organizer, finding speakers. That's a lot of times I have booked speakers that I've just met on Twitter and didn't know them in person yet.
Yeah, I think it's this like seeing the, there's that saying, see the forest for the trees. This is almost the reverse, like see the trees instead of the forest, like instead of this like blur of content, this kind of feed of content that goes by, really seeing that there's people behind this content and picking out those people that you connect with. And remembering that there is actually a flesh and blood human being behind each of these little modules on a Twitter feed.
Yeah. And, you know, people tell you, you know, if you want to get your name out there, if you want to be known as an expert, you should be blogging. And not everyone has that in them or, you know, it's hard. I have a hard time writing things myself. And a lot of the followers I built up came from sharing other people's information. I just became like a curator of content and not a creator. And that still made me, you know, people still followed me, were looking from tweets I would share, and it wasn't even my content. I'd still, and of course, give the credit to whoever wrote it because now they know that you're tweeting their content and maybe they'll follow you. And so that was another way that I built up a community on Twitter, which is sharing content.
Right.
Also, another great thing, if you're comfortable doing it and you're looking for a job, put it out on Twitter. Say exactly what you're looking for, what your experience is, and ask people to retweet. I also like to use GIFs. It helps with the retweets as well, if you find an appropriate one. And, you know, people who don't even know you will share it just because, I mean, a lot of people want to help people on Twitter. Not everyone wants to destroy you. And so they'll retweet it. And you can get DMs and people say, oh, did you hear about this? And it's helped a lot.
So I didn't know you were looking now. I know that you were focusing on the coaching and all the event organizing. And I figured like, oh, this has got to be the full-time thing now because Angel's doing so much. What is the, just out of curiosity and to just put it out there, what is that dream job? What are you looking for?
No, it's so funny. So I left my job in August and I was going to take a break because I had all these other things going on and I did want to figure out what I wanted to do. My plan was to just get through Refactor 2020 and then decide what I wanted to do. And Refactor 2020 was supposed to happen in April. And then we rescheduled for August. And I was like, okay, that's all right. I'll wait till August and then I'll start. And then it was clear it wasn't really going to happen in August either. But now it's happening in September of next year. And now I'm thinking, oh, I should really find a job. I mean, how long can you just sit around and watch Netflix? Oh. And of course, I end up looking in the middle of a pandemic, which was not the best decision I've made. But I am looking at, like, you know, design roles. I was a product manager when I left my job, but I think I'm better suited for design. I really like the creative aspect of it a little bit more. I think that things you learn in product management can definitely carry over nicely into design. But also, when I hear about them or see them, I love roles that are maybe more community focused. A way to do what I do on the side, professionally be great, So I've looked at those. They're not as many, especially with events kind of slowing down. The companies aren't always looking for them. But when I hear about them, those are things I'm interested in as well. Definitely want to be remote this time.
Yes. I mean, I've seen roles for like employee experience. Like they're not HR people, but they're like there to design the experience of being an employee.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was just talking to a friend who has a company and I was saying this role exists. I wasn't pitching myself for it, but I was like, this role exists and I can't describe it. And I don't know what it's always called because I've seen it described differently, but I think it's a really great role if you have a company and you don't even have an HR, especially if you don't have an HR person, to have someone who, like you said, kind of designs the experience for the employees.
And that's like, I think even more important now as so much of being an employee mm-hmm. is now remote. Like how do you create cohesiveness and how do you create mm-hmm. a team environment and make sure people are communicating mm-hmm. when so much is happening remote? I mean, that would be a really interesting thing to design. And
you know, now that you mention it, that's another question I ask now in interviews is how are you collaborating remotely? How has that changed? Is this a shift that happened with COVID? How are you adjusting to that? Was it before, you know, what has changed since COVID or what is your focus now? Or what could you do better? I want to hear how people are talking to each other and communicating at a company now because it's so important now, especially you can't see each other every day, that if you don't have that figured out, it could be a very frustrating experience, especially as a new employee. So I definitely like to find out how people are making that transition.
I mean, onboarding in the middle of COVID. I have two friends that have started at a new place in the middle of COVID and they're like, it's so weird. I've not met anybody in person. Which even like when you meet somebody in person for the interview or like you have at least like one human interaction, then it's a lot easier mm-hmm. to go remote. But for somebody coming in who has never seen that person, these people face to face, it's kind of a weird trip.
Yeah. It also reminds me to say this, something I've noticed is if you can find out the entire interview process as early as possible, some of these companies are doing really dumb stuff and it's better to find out as soon as possible before you waste your time on a process that just won't work for you.
I mean, can you elaborate? Like what are some things that to watch out for?
I think it's based on what you're willing to do, but I got an email, I think it was last week, and they told me the process in the email. This is the first email interaction I've had with them. I submitted an application. They said, this is our process. We want you to do a project, 2 hours, and then we'll decide whether we want to talk to you. And I don't even know what kind of information I'm going to give you in 2 hours. Like, I don't even know what you can process. You know, the project was something like, design this dashboard so that people can see their activity. That was the assignment.
Oh my gosh. 2 hours.
And I was like, okay, but I don't have any information or background and I don't know how that's going to be. You're not going to see my process in 2 hours. My process is in 2 hours like that. So I just moved on and I didn't do it. And I'm grateful that I found out what the process was immediately.
Going back to this awakening that we hope is actually happening mm-hmm. in the world. There has been so much content created in the past, books, blog posts, that now is, you know, coming to the forefront of a lot of people's minds. Lots of content, movies, shows, podcasts. I was on Eventbrite the other day, actually, and I did see something interesting on Eventbrite where now they have a tool where you can find protests that are happening in your area, or they actually have a tool to create your own protest. And that got me thinking, like, have you started thinking about tools or actually like innovations that can help us, like help unite us, help combat bias, help white people recognize and understand their privilege? Have you started thinking about maybe how technology can actually provide tools to help with this awakening?
You know, I haven't. I've just, to be honest, I think because, you know, it's great to see the awakening happening, but it's also kind of an exhausting time. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of doing more hasn't struck me yet. I just, you know, this, and I'm not the only one who said this, and I've talked to people, friends who are going through this, you know, not sleeping well and losing focus. And so I've just kind of been trying to focus on the things that I just have to do right now, mm-hmm. and less on the things that I might want to do, or, you know, just coming up with solutions to things. It has not occurred to me, honestly. I don't have as much energy as I usually do. That's why trying to keep these events going in some kind of online fashion to kind of get back to a little bit of normalcy. Mm-hmm. But I haven't. And I know there are tools out there. There's an app actually called Your Black Friends Are Busy.
Okay.
It has like resources, you know, places you can donate, books you can read, podcasts. I mean, I haven't personally vetted it. And I know there's some books on there that I don't recommend necessarily, but it is a place to start if you're really looking for, like, what do I do next? Also, I have a friend, Kim Creighton. She's got a podcast. It's called Cause a Scene. You can check out her website. She's got a webinar series that you can join on how to be anti-racist. She does this all the time. COVID or no, this is what she does. She's really well equipped at it. And so it never occurred to me to do these things because I know someone who does it better than I can do. Mm-hmm. And so I just think there are some things out there that you can do, places, things you can find. And yeah, I just don't, these conversations are kind of tiring, and there are people who are equipped to have those conversations more often who have the energy for it and the stamina. But, you know, outside like conversations sometimes with white friends, I don't have the, I know I don't have the energy to have these conversations and think about solutions. That's just, I love the people who do it because I don't think I could. I talk to my dad a couple times a week, and he's like watching the news a lot, and he's on Facebook a lot, and just having these conversations with him is probably all I can handle mentally, to be honest.
No, that's really, I mean, I can't imagine, actually. I was going to say I can't imagine how exhausting it would be, but I'm going to rephrase that to I can't imagine how exhausting it would be. And that's mm-hmm. a 100% fair answer. But, you know, we've known each other for a few years, and you mm-hmm. know how I'm such a problem solver. And I'm yeah. like, I want to create a new solution.
I do like to solve. I do too. Like, what's the problem? How do we solve this?
Yeah.
And I think this is just one of those areas. That I don't know that I have the ability to, or just the, like I said, energy to do it. Mm-hmm. But support people who are doing it because it's taking a mental toll on them in addition to just the work they're doing. So, you know, Kim Creighton, there are so many ways you can support her as a monthly sponsor. You can sponsor her. So there are people who are doing this work and just understand that there's an emotional toll that comes with it. And so support them.
Of course. Yeah. And I will link to all of those resources right. that you've mentioned. I will definitely link to those. And I think I actually met Kim at mm-hmm. a conference of yours last year, or maybe the year before. Her name sounds really familiar.
The last We Rise, she was our last keynote speaker, actually. So it might have been you were at
that's
We Rise.
That's probably where I met her. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay. So I just have a couple more fun questions. Okay, so of all of the things that you love in the world, you're a very enthusiastic person. You also love wine a lot, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. What are you drinking now? Like, what is the stuff that you would like recommend? Like, what's new in your wine playlist?
So it's funny. I tend not to leave my house right now. I avoid it. And so I have my groceries delivered, but the one thing I can't have delivered is wine. Mm-hmm. And so I have not been drinking as much as I thought I would because I just don't have it. I was just trying to figure out, cause I have to leave the house on Friday, and I was like, how can I get to the grocery store to get wine? So, but generally I try to be more fancy, but I think just in the last few months, I've been keeping it pretty simple. So I've been drinking Apothic because they have a really good red, white, and rosé. And it's really easy to find at most grocery stores. So I'm not being really picky.
I love it. Oh, Apothic Red is so, like, it's such a juicy wine. And it's like the price point is great. And that's definitely one of my go-tos.
Yeah. So I'm not being fancy right now. Anytime I can get Apothic anything, I'll take the red, white, or rosé right now. And I really have not, I think I've been trying, I've only been buying one or two at a time because I don't want to look like a person who's going to buy a case of wine right now. And I really should have because now I am down to just Apothic Red and I now want more wine. So it's hard to figure out how to tastefully buy enough wine to get you through
Well, we just like haven't even like we're getting our groceries delivered as well, but we are going to the store for the wine and we just kind of like mask it up, go at a time where it's not busy, beeline to the wine section, only touch the bottles of wine, touch nothing else and get out. But yeah, it's literally like wine missions.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to like I said, I'm leaving on Friday and I'm just gonna have to suck it up and buy a large amount of wine. So, cause we're in Georgia and I don't know what's happening. We could find ourselves locked in again. So I just want to have enough wine to get through the summer.
Yeah. There's some like wine delivery.
I know there are. And it's just like, I know there's someone who I got a tweet actually. He tweeted at me when I mentioned wine or something and said that he delivers wine. But you have to charge, he pays a delivery fee and you have to pick the wine that's available at the store. And I just felt like I live a block away from the grocery store. I should be able to do this on my own. So I never went through with it. But there are ways I think you can get them shipped and stuff. But I just always tell myself, you're so close, just go get it. And then I find myself without wine. So I haven't figured this wine thing out.
Okay. Well, we're working on it too. So I will, I'll let you know if I figure out some solutions. So that was kind of my random question, because I'm a wine drinker as well. So I wanted to know if you had any tips, but, I'm going to definitely link to your website and your Twitter and all the things. Is there anywhere else you want to send people to, anything that you want our listeners to know about that you're working on? Or anywhere that they need to kind of go to find out more about you and your projects?
Yeah, I mean, so my groups, the meetup groups I'm in, they're based in Atlanta, but for the foreseeable future, at least a couple months, we're doing online events. So hopefully I'll give you the links to my meetup group. So Women of Code Atlanta, we actually have a meetup on the 7th, which is like a virtual networking event for startup founders to find technical co-founders. So that might be the thing you're interested in. Our online events for Refactor.tech, which is the website as well. That's what's going on. That's what I'm doing.
Staying busy. Very busy. All right. Well, hopefully in the near future, we will be sharing a glass of wine in person. I would love that. And sorry about our few technical difficulties here, but thank you, Angel. Thank you so much for your time, your insights, your awesome advice that you gave, and everything that you do for Atlanta and for this community.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too.
Thanks for hanging out with the UX Hustle. For show notes and more episodes, go to uxhustle.org/podcast. And remember, don't wait for inspiration to act. Act to get inspired.